We're pleased to continue our study in this sixth chapter of Joshua. In this chapter, we have the great story told of the fall of the city of Jericho, how the people of God were told to march around the wall of Jericho. They would do this on a daily basis for 6 days. Then on the seventh day, they marched around it seven times. This group that marched around the wall was composed of the men of war who led the group. They were followed by the seven priests who blew on the seven trumpets made of ram's horns. And then they were followed by the priest who bore the Ark of the Covenant. And then the rear guard followed this. And from the way this is worded, a great majority, if not all, of the people did participate in this march around the wall of Jericho. And on the seventh day, after they'd marched around it for seven times, and of course up to this point nothing had seemed to have happened at all, then they blew on the trumpets very loud, and all the people shouted, and at that time then the wall fell down flat. As he says in verse 20, "So the people shouted when the priest blew with the trumpets, and it came to pass, when the people heard the shout of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox, and sheep, and ass, with the edge of the sword." And this was according to the instruction of God. They were to spare nothing in this city, nothing alive, and to take no possessions for themselves, except, of course, they were to spare the lives of Rahab and her household. So beginning with verse 22, "But Joshua had said unto the two men that had spied out the country, Go into the harlot's house, and bring out thence the woman, and all that she hath, as ye swear unto her." So the men who had been the two spies originally, who knew best where Rahab's house was, who could recognize Rahab, they were given the duty then of going to her house and bringing the woman out and all that she has according to the agreement that they had made with Rahab. Verse 23, "And the young men that were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brethren and all that she had. And they brought them out, all her kindred, and left them without the camp of Israel." So they did do according to their agreement, and you know Rahab did specify that she wanted her father's house spared and all that was in her father's house. And so this was carried about. And somebody will say, well, if her house was on the wall and the wall fell down flat, how could she have been spared? But the wall didn't have to all fall. As a matter of fact, it would have probably been a military advantage if a good part of this wall remained intact. Enough of it fell so that the soldiers of Israel could enter into the city with ease, and there they could then slay the inhabitants of the city of Jericho. Had all the wall fallen, no doubt many people would have had a greater ability to have escaped. But at any rate, it would be easy for us to see how that this portion of the wall that bore the house of Rahab and her family could have been spared. Now note he says that he left them without the camp of Israel. These persons who had been spared, Rahab and her family, were not citizens of Israel. They were not members of the household of God. So they had to spend a certain amount of time outside of the camp of Israel and to purify themselves, to become free of the paganistic ideas and the idolatrous practices that they no doubt had before they learned about the true and living God, before they could then become proselytes of the house of Israel. And of course now they did become members of the house of Israel. We find that Rahab married Salmon, and they begat Boaz, and Boaz's son was Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse was the father of David, so that she was in the lineage of Jesus Christ, our Lord. And also, we have her mentioned in the New Testament, in James and Hebrews, as being a great example of faith. So Rahab did become a member of the household of Israel, but at this particular time, she had to dwell for a period without the camp until she became qualified to be in the house of Israel. Now, we'd like to also again point out the fact that it was Rahab's house that was the place of safety. This was the place where salvation was to be found in this city of Jericho. And that's a type of the church in the world. And those today who are in the church are not going to be destroyed along with the rest of the world like the world is going to be destroyed. They're going to be saved. And one important thing is they must remain, though, in the church for this to occur. Had those people in Rahab's house left the house and gone wandering out through the streets of Jericho, when the time of destruction came, they would not have been saved. They would not have been spared. And so it is today in the church. Although we are in the church and we have the safety of the church, if we decide to leave the church and go without into the world and not remain in our station as God would have us to, then we're going to lose our safety and we're going to be lost as a result of it. Verse 24, "And they burnt the city with fire, and all that was therein, only the silver and the gold and the vessels of brass and of iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord." So the city was utterly destroyed. Not only were the inhabitants slain, except for Rahab and her house, but the city was burned with fire, and everything that was in it was burned. Only the vessels of brass and iron and the silver and the gold, and they were put in the treasury of the house of the Lord, so that they were not kept for any private use of any individual. God did not intend for them to do this. This was strictly for the use and the glory of God and the treasury of God. Now, we see here that Jericho was a kind of a first fruits. And as this people entered into this land of Canaan, the first city that they subdued, this great city of Jericho, was then the Lord's. They could take nothing as personal possession. The spoils of war were not divided among the individual people. And, of course, we see today that God still intends for us to give a portion of our means. The early church was commanded on the first day of the week to lay by in store as God had prospered them or as had purposed in their heart. And we today still must not neglect our duty of giving of our means to the work of God. The first sin that we have recorded in the next chapter is of a violation of this principle. One of the persons, and we'll read about it as we get there, one of the persons took part of the goods of this city for his own personal use. And the whole nation of Israel suffered because of that sin. As we study about the fall of this city of Jericho and the destruction of all that was within the city, I'd like to read from Halley's Bible Handbook concerning an archaeological note on this subject. To quote, "Dr. John Garstang, director of the British School of Archaeology in Jerusalem and of the Department of Antiquities of the Palestinian government, excavated the ruins of Jericho in 1929 through 1936. He found pottery and scarab evidence that the city had been destroyed about 1400 BC, coinciding with Joshua's date, and in a number of details, dug up evidence concerning the biblical account in a most remarkable way. In verse 20, the statement is made, the wall fell down flat. Dr. Garstang found that the wall did actually fall down flat. The wall was double, the two walls being 15 feet apart, the outer wall 6 feet thick, the inner wall 12 feet thick, both being about 30 feet high. They were built not very substantially on faulty, uneven foundations of brick 4 inches thick and 1 to 2 feet long, laid in mud mortar. The two walls were linked together by houses built across the top as Rahab's house on the wall. Dr. Garstang found that the outer wall fell outward and down the hillside, dragging the inner wall and houses with it, the streak of bricks gradually getting thinner down the slope. The foundation walls of the palace, 4 courses of stone high, remain in situ, tilted outward. Dr. Garstang thinks there are indications that the wall was shaken down by an earthquake, of which traces may be seen, a method which God could have used as easily as any other. Verse 24 says they burnt the city with fire. Signs of the conflagration and destruction are very marked. Garstang found great layers of charcoal and ashes and wall ruins reddened by fire. The outer wall suffered most. Houses alongside the wall were burned to the ground. The stratum generally was covered with a deep layer of black burnt debris, under which there were pockets of white ash overlaid with a layer of fallen reddish brick. Verse 18 says, "Keep yourself from the devoted thing." Garstang found under the ashes and fallen walls, in the ruins of storerooms, an abundance of foodstuffs, wheat, barley, dates, lentils, and such, turned to charcoal by intense heat, untouched and uneaten, evidence that the conquerors refrained from appropriating the food. So that account of the archaeological excavation of the city of Jericho, hundreds or in thousands of years after this destruction, is most interesting, and it is heartening to us to note that these scientific findings do bear out the account given in the Bible. Verse 25, "And Joshua saved Rahab the harlot alive, and her father's household, and all that she had. And she dwelleth in Israel even unto this day, because she hid the messengers which Joshua sent to spy out Jericho." That verse just restates and affirms the fact that because of this great faith that Rahab had, and because of the fact that she acted upon her faith in saving these spies and kept them alive, that then she was saved, her house was saved, and she dwelleth in Israel even unto this day. So she remained then a faithful follower of God and a member of the nation of Israel. Verse 26, "And Joshua adjured them at the time, saying, Cursed be the man before the Lord that riseth up and buildeth this city of Jericho. He shall lay the foundation thereof in his firstborn, and in his youngest son shall he set up the gates of it." Now what Joshua is doing here is placing a curse upon any man that would rise up and rebuild this city of Jericho. And he simply says that when he lays the foundation thereof, he's going to have to give up his firstborn. And then when he sets up the gates of it, he's going to have to give up his youngest son. Now, no doubt this would even imply that he would lose all of the children in between the first and the last. We read in 1 Kings 16:34 where this town of Jericho was rebuilt. There was a man named Hiel who lived during the time of Ahab, which would be about 900 B.C., around 500 years after Jericho had been destroyed, who did set about to rebuild the city of Jericho. So in this verse, the 34th verse of 1 Kings 16, "And in his days did Hiel the Bethelite build Jericho. He laid the foundation thereof in Abram, his firstborn, and set up the gates thereof in his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spake by Joshua the son of Nun." So we have an amazing fulfillment of this curse that Joshua placed upon the one who would rebuild the city of Jericho. Again, I'd like to read an archaeological note about this found in Halley's Bible Handbook, in which he states, quote, "An amazing fulfillment of Joshua's prediction 500 years before in Joshua 6:26. The ruins of Jericho show that it was inhabited continuously from pre-Abrahamic times to about 1400 B.C. That was the time, of course, that Joshua destroyed the city, with no signs of habitation from then to the 9th century B.C., the time of Ahab, the ruins of which are very small. In this stratum, a large house was uncovered, which may have been the house of Hiel. A jar with the remains of a child was found in the masonry of a gate, and 2 such jars in the walls of a house." So that is a very interesting note concerning this prophecy that Joshua made. Now, I would like to point this out, that although the curse is placed upon the man who would rebuild the city, It does not mean that there would be any curse placed upon those who would afterwards dwell in the city that was rebuilt. And this city, of course, was one that we read about in later years, in which Elijah and Elisha also visited, and even our Savior, Jesus Christ, visited. But I would like to point out another thing, that the modern Jericho is a mile or so away from the ruins of this old city that was destroyed by Joshua. And so that it may mean that the city that was built on a different site would not be accounted to be the same identical Jericho as the one that was destroyed in the days of Joshua. But it definitely encourages our faith and our belief in the Bible. When we read about a prophecy being given, then we also read about the fulfillment of it. We realize that God is not mocked, that God does not make foolish and meaningless statements. Everything God says has very great and deep meaning. It's going to be brought to pass, and the very best thing we can possibly do is to learn about it and bring our lives into an agreement with this will of God. So in verse 27, he closes this sixth chapter by saying, "So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was noised throughout all the country." So now that this great defeat of the city of Jericho had come about, the fame of Joshua was noised throughout all the country. Everybody in the country was now talking about this great general. This man who was able to bring about such a sweeping defeat of this walled city of Jericho. His fame was made known, and it was because the Lord was with Joshua. The Lord was with him in what he did, because Joshua then was obedient to the Lord. Now we'd like to move on into the seventh chapter of Joshua. And we notice this chapter begins with the word "but." Now, he's just got through saying that the Lord was with Joshua and his fame spread throughout all the country. But there is an exception to this. But, and we're going to find that that "but" is brought about by the fact that this people had sinned against God. "But the children of Israel committed a trespass in the accursed thing." Now, he states that the children of Israel did this. However, we're going to find that it was one man who was guilty. But because this one man was a member of the household of God, and because he was partaker of all the good things that God's people had, then whenever he sinned, then to that extent, all the people became guilty. That is, all the people had to suffer the consequences for his act. And he said the children of Israel committed a trespass in the accursed thing. That is, although they carried out this duty to the very letter of slaying all the inhabitants of the city as God told them to, and they didn't show mercy as the natural man might show mercy, yet here was one who yielded to this natural tendency to want to acquire wealth. And it's called the accursed thing. The thing God had told them to stay away from, the thing God had told them to not to partake of at all, this one person did. Now, as we stop and look at it from a strictly human viewpoint, it's a wonder that more people did not violate this rule than did. But here one did violate it, and all are going to suffer. He committed a trespass and the accursed thing. You know, sin is transgression of the law. When we trespass, when we go beyond that which God has commanded us to do, or that which God has allowed us to do, then we have sinned. And it is a trespass to do this. And this person committed this very thing. "For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed thing. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against the children of Israel." Now, this may seem to be a strange thing to us, that God would be angry with the whole household of Israel simply because of the sin of one person. But since being in the household of Israel was protection to all, then when one violated the rules of God, it was a threat to all then to continue to harbor this one in his sin. And this is the way God feels about sin. He does not want us to look lightly upon sin. If we have sin in our midst, we do not have the luxury of being able to just simply shrug our shoulders and say, oh well, so what? We have to give it some strong, serious consideration, because if we look lightly upon the sin which is in our midst, and which we then, by upholding and condoning it, we then can make ourselves indirectly a participant of it, then we then can become to that extent guilty of this same sin. We cannot afford to allow teachers to teach false doctrine and go unchecked. We can't support them. We can't condone them. We can't say, I bid you Godspeed, or we're going to be protector of his evil deed. We can't allow those to give us guidance and direction who are guilty of sin themselves, and who then may cause us to be protectors of their sins. And this is an important principle. It applies in the New Testament age just as well as it did in the Old Testament time. So we see the anger of the Lord was kindled against the children of Israel. Well, our time has expired at this point. So till next time, this is Dr. N.C. Crouch saying goodbye, friends.